This is Captain Pike. We have one job. Protect Commander Burnham until she reaches her target.
Section 31 is in our way. Get it done.
In 5, 4, 3, 2, mark!
Go, Michael, now!
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the exploding bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, doing a half-assed job because now's the perfect time.
Wait, what's your excuse all the other weeks?
I have no excuse. I'm sorry, Cam.
We're here this week to talk about a quiet little episode of Star Trek.
Perhaps the quietest episode we've ever seen of the series.
Called Such Sweet Sorrow, Part 2.
Sorry, lessons. Yeah. They've taken your mantle.
No kidding. I don't know that I ever could have been prepared for what I just witnessed, Tyler, this almost 90-minute episode.
So going into this, I think you and I thought that maybe like the first act would be kind of like action-filled, and then they'd tackle a lot of like the time travel stuff.
Yeah.
I had no idea we were in store for a near feature-length action sequence. This is like Peter Jackson directing, you know, the finale.
No, this was better than Peter Jackson doing it, because I saw those Hobbit movies.
Well, do you remember that last Hobbit movie?
Yeah.
The final act amounted to a 90-minute action sequence where I think you and I saw it together.
Yeah.
We were bored out of our minds. Yeah. I'll say this about this episode here. I was not bored watching this. I usually get so bored watching like Hollywood blockbusters because I'm not attached to what's going on with the action because there's no emotional stakes. There are so many emotional stakes throughout this one.
Yeah.
And I can actually follow the action. The action actually makes sense. It's not this, you know, Jason Bourne sort of like shaky cam stuff that I'm...
Not so much Jason Bourne, but the things inspired by Jason Bourne.
You're 100% correct, because actually I do think the action sequences in Jason Bourne are very discernible, easy to follow.
Another correction. We're not talking about the movie Jason Bourne. We're talking about the Bourne trilogy.
Fair enough.
Not the movie Jason Bourne. That one sucks.
Yeah. So look, probably the most explosive episode that we've seen of Discovery, period. This is, I think...
Discovery or Star Trek?
You know what? I'll take that back. Yes. Is there any other episode of Star Trek that amounts to what is essentially just an action sequence?
No.
And I'm saying this is not a bad thing. This is actually an episode that works for me in a way that Will You Take My Hand did not quite measure up to, where the conclusion...
That was not Starfleet.
It involves people walking around with umbrellas in Paris. Right. Literally.
So that'll be the season 3 finale. They'll be in Venice or something.
I hope so.
I, partway through this episode, realized I was watching a episode of Star Trek that will go down in the books. You know, we can have maybe quibbles as we go forward and maybe some little plot points or whatever, story details. But Star Trek has never done spectacle on this scale in TV in the history of the franchise. And never to this level of high impact. Like, I was stunned. You know, you said The Hobbit. I was thinking almost like of Rogue One, that second hour of Rogue One, where it's just one extended long action scene.
Well, you're using an example of good action.
Yeah, I am.
And I'm
good.
Using an example of bad action.
That's right.
Yeah.
But, like, this was something that, like, I never dreamed I would see on a TV Star Trek show. I give huge props to CBS All Access.
And the budget that they're willing
they
to
went
put down.
All in, because I really do think this is the type of episode that gets people talking.
Okay, so the moment that really sold it for me, though, is like there's one particular shot where Section 31 fleet closes in and you see the Enterprise and the Discovery like next to each other in a way that doesn't quite make logical sense for like what space battle would actually look like, you know. But I saw this particular shot, and it was just majestic, and I knew all the people that were on each of the ships, and I cared so very much about their fates.
Especially Poe.
Especially Poe.
Yeah.
We joke about Poe.
Yeah.
She is growing on me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm digging the Poe.
Right.
But in this situation, I was like, wow, I actually would like to see this continue on in a way, and if this is all this episode is going to be, is like one giant action sequence.
Yeah.
Well, the action is actually like easy to follow. I understand what's going on. I care about everybody involved with it. This is working for me, and it's not something I would have thought, because typically with like kind of, you know, TV nowadays, what they like to do is have like the big climax on the penultimate episode.
Sure.
And then all the resolution in the finale.
Right.
They actually did the flip thing where, you know, Such Sweet Sorrow, we got a lot of partying last week. Those are kind of the emotional beats. But Cam, there were still so many emotional beats
this week.
We
got a lot of torn aparting.
That's very true. So I wonder, what is your take with regards to like a finale like this? Does this work for you as a finale, or does it leave you wanting something? And I'm not saying
What more I could want.
Well,
we can go into maybe quibbles about, I don't know, science of the episode or something, or, you know, little bits here and there. But I mean, I think Discovery really set a bar tonight.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they could ever meet that again. I mean, this really does feel like a bar setter for Star Trek finales. And I'm kind of stunned because we've watched this whole season two. I don't know if there's another episode in this whole season that could have prepared me for what this episode was. And I want to apologize to listeners who maybe think we missed things along the way. This is an episode I'm going to need to rewatch, because this was just like a flurry thrown at me. But I was completely absorbed. And, you know, when it started off with little Section 31 ships splitting off, I'm thinking in my head like, yeah, kind of saw this in Star Trek Beyond. And then it was just like, why was Star Trek Beyond not this good?
What, were you waiting for Sabotage to start screaming across?
Oh, God. But it's like, I haven't seen extended action in Star Trek in the movies very often that's come close to this. Like,
I'd say probably the best would maybe be the 2009 JJ
the opening
movie. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that still might be the best 7 minutes of Star Trek.
Sure. I mean, you could say the best ship battle is maybe the Wrath of Khan one, but it's also an entirely different animal in terms of, you know, it's two ships in a nebula.
Well, this doesn't seem as if it was aping any of the other sort of Star Trek action sequences. This was a beast of its own.
It felt very Star Wars. There's a lot of like Star Wars-ish music cues. A lot of the camera work and everything felt very Star Wars. There was these quick zooms, which J.J. Abrams used, I know, in 2009. But George Lucas was using those in the prequels a lot.
But even like some of the cool stuff when like those shuttles were leaving the shuttle bay from the Discovery. Yeah. And look, they've been doing a lot of weird angles throughout all of season two. Look, make it interesting, go for it.
Yeah.
But I keep getting sucked in by this stuff. And look, if you told me I was going to have like a big action episode for the finale, I would have been very fearful, because I just get bored watching this action stuff.
Yeah.
We're talking about how great the action works. Maybe let's talk about the character stuff.
Yeah.
It really matters here. The highlight for me, though, the Spock and Burnham party.
They paid all of that off absolutely beautifully. And I mean, we, you know, had our complaints through the first half of season two, talking about where's Spock? But they managed to get a lot done in the handful of episodes he was in, and that this emotional payoff to their journey really, really worked. And I know there's going to be, even as it's happening, I could tell there's going to be nitpicks of people pointing out, like, why would, you know, yes, the whole family's not going to mention Burnham's name again.
They've sworn to secrecy.
Yeah, like, oh, sure, okay, whatever. But I don't care. In the moment, this entirely worked for what this show is, the journey the show is taking us on. This completely worked.
Well, when they say that, you know, I don't want to let go, or when Burnham says that, and then Spock replies, neither do I.
Yeah.
I buy this. Do you think it's going a little bit too far where he says in Vulcan, I love you, and then she replies back, I love you too? Have we ever heard Spock ever say, I love you?
I think that's an interesting point, though, because he does say, without you, I won't be able to maintain this balance.
Yeah.
And we see going forward, he is the, you know, a little chillier, more Vulcan Spock.
He falls into that Vulcan path that his father had carved out versus Amanda.
Right. Like, Burnham was the one who was kind of keeping him on that balance between the human and the Vulcan.
She does give him some very prescient advice, though.
If you ever meet a man named Jim.
You know, and that's another reason why that emotional beat works for me, where we question a lot, you know, going back to the series premiere, where it's just like, does Burnham really matter at all to Spock's life?
Yeah.
They sell me on this. I'm like, oh boy, do they. Like, whether it's retconning, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I buy that she is a significant influence on this man's journey going forward and everything that we see to come with his character.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, 100%. And, you know, like I was reading one of the Star Trek Discovery spinoff novels, and there's like a setup for Kirk in the future. And they're just kind of like, they meet the young boy Kirk, and they're like, maybe one day that child could be a great starship captain. I'm like, this is BS. Yeah. Like, it's such crap, like fan wankery, right? Yeah. But like, I look at how it's done here. And yeah, you could maybe make jokes about, well, this is really on the nose, setting up this friendship, but it's born entirely out of an emotional conversation between these two. So I'm in because these two actors are so great, their chemistry is fantastic, and I'm able to go along with, like, I understand exactly what she's saying, and that Spock was able to connect with her, and he needs to be able to do this with someone else. It makes complete sense.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think we need to touch on, because I think a lot of people are going to be wondering about this, is kind of the setup for season three and whether or not there's going to be an Enterprise sort of spinoff going forward.
Yeah.
So I have two, I guess, incongruous thoughts right now. Is the finale setting up the Enterprise searching out for Discovery with that final signal in the Beta Quadrant that is 51,000 light years away, which is about a 50-year journey for them? Or is it setting up, hey, where do you want to go, Captain? Anywhere I want, right?
And so I was going back and forth on that.
So I don't know if the Enterprise...
Is it ambiguous in the sense that it does leave the door open?
Okay, so I'll try to use some sort of logic here in that I think what they wanted...
Very Vulcan of you.
I know. I think that what they want to do is leave the door open, as you say, for this 1701 spinoff, whereas maybe the Enterprise is also open to play a part in season three, and what is in store for the Discovery moving forward? That's another question that we can debate in just a moment. But what do you, what would you like to see? Not necessarily what you think is going to happen, but what would you like to see with regards to the future that's being set up here with the 1701?
If they're searching out Discovery, I don't know that that works. Here's the thing, like, I am completely fine if Discovery is, from this point forward, a ship in the future. Like, that's the whole rest of the series, because that makes sense to me, and that actually lines up with everything they're setting up here as to why Burnham's never going to be mentioned, Discovery was blown up in the battle. All that makes sense in terms of the canon, right? Like, to have them suddenly pop back up, it's like, so wait, are we going to retcon their existence now back in this timeline?
Yeah.
So I can completely believe that that's the end. They said goodbye to Discovery in this moment. I don't really want to see them doing a series tracking down the Discovery, because I don't really want them to find it.
So are you saying, like, you wouldn't want to see a spinoff series about that, or you wouldn't want to see the Enterprise in season three trying to track down the Discovery?
It just doesn't really make sense to me. It feels like a mission that's kind of pointless.
Well, what I'm getting at is, if there's two paths here, the Enterprise being involved...
The spinoff is what I would prefer, where it's a completely separate show.
Yeah.
But the only thing that gives me pause is... You know, and this is not tied to the Enterprise. You can completely write off Pike, Spock, number one. Like, that can be its own spinoff. Or if, for some reason, some bizarre reason, given how great they were, they wanted to stop it here, that's fine. We got our Enterprise crew, and that's the end of it. The only thing that gives me pause is, like, the leaving Ash Tyler behind. I'm like, there's still ties to Discovery.
That's what I'm wondering as well. Yeah. Because they have tried everything they can to wedge this guy into the show, even though I think his arc concluded in... you know, in a satisfying way by the end of season one.
Sure.
But the other thing that I'm questioning is, like, Giorgio is on the Discovery.
Yes.
So what is this Section 31 spinoff are they talking about? Look, maybe it's not a Section 31 spinoff.
It's just a Giorgio
spinoff. It's just a Giorgio spinoff, which I'm far more interested in after this season than I ever was in a Section 31 Giorgio-led spinoff.
Did they say it was Section 31?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
I think, look... If it's from the J.J. Abrams school of marketing...
No kidding.
They can mislead people as much as they want.
Yeah.
Cam, look, you know me. I was never a fan of Giorgio in season one. Mm-hmm. I'm totally sold on this character at this point. If they want to give Michelle Yeoh a spinoff... It's fascinating to see Tyler 3.5 months ago, who I was like, absolutely not. Never in my life.
Yeah.
Now I'm totally down for it. But look, if they can, like, suck her out of the future somehow, put her back in a cool setting... But where does Ash Tyler fit in all this, Cam? I have no clue.
Because I had theorized that he was going to be on the Section 31 spinoff. You could write him out of Discovery that way. And in a way, that's the case, in that he is now overseeing Section 31. Like, he's
which is bizarre.
It is, yeah. But that piece is in the right place for to set up for the spinoff. But now Giorgio's in the future. This is where it all gets so confusing, and I think we're going to be playing this game like for the next year or something, or whenever Discovery Season 3 starts. All leading up to that, it's going to be people wanting to try and figure out where this show is going.
Okay, so we both agree we would like to see a 1701 spinoff. I think they've set up everything for that.
The only thing is, they need a direction for it. That's something that I'm still not clear as to what that would be.
Okay, so you say that they need a direction for it. I'm okay if it's just a more episodic series than we have with Discovery.
So am I, but do you think they'll do that?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
So what's the hook? I really hope it's not them trying to track down the Discovery while in season 3 we're following the adventures of the Discovery in the future.
It's the search for boys.
I love it. So let's jump into the future of Discovery as well, because I think that's another barn burner of a conversation that people are going to be having right now. As you say, if this is what the series is going forward, Cam, I think it has finally found like a raison d'etre at this point.
Right.
That is something I've always been questioning throughout the run of the series. Seasons 1, season 2, I keep saying to you, like, Cam, I like the characters, I like the setting, I just don't know what the series is about. What is the general theme? Like, what is the hook that you go in and you pitch it in half a sentence and then you can explain it to the average person? If you're like, hey, a ship lost in time.
Right.
I get that. Right. That's not something that we've seen before in Star Trek. I think moving forward, if it is a ship lost in time in the future, it's trying to maybe even rebuild the Federation to a certain degree. I just hope people aren't going to make comparisons to Kevin Sorbo's Andromeda, which was the hook of that entire series.
Oh, was it really?
It was, yeah. Okay. So, it was very much...
That would be
much...
amazing if they got there and Kevin Sorbo was, like, flying by in a ship.
I could buy that.
But he was dressed as Hercules.
But, look... I'm down for the future of Discovery, however long that might be. I don't know if it's just going to be a season 3 we're stuck in time, or if that is going to be the permanent, basis for the series. I'm down for this. It makes sense to me. It works within the canon. It works within what makes this series, great with the characters. There's going to be a lot to delve into.
Right.
And I wonder if it also lends itself to more of the episodic adventures on a planet, discovering new life, seeing how the universe has changed in like the nearly 1,000 years it's been.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think one of the things that Star Trek has struggled with is that when they've done these prequel series, is that they kind of want to revisit the greatest hits. And sometimes that's great. I love when they'll expand on things like the Andorians on Enterprise or things like that. But it did seem sometimes like Discovery was struggling to basically make sense of itself. Season 1, we've got this Klingon arc, we've got Mirror Universe stuff, and it's like, okay, like, where's this show going? And season 2, we get, kind of this return to the original crew of, Pike and everything, and you're like, okay, cool. Is Discovery just a show based on setting up TOS? And, like, which is kind of weird. Like, you don't really want to be the Star Trek show that's job is to just set up another beloved show. That's kind of a thankless gig, ultimately.
Pike spinoff.
But when it all is said and done, it's kind of like that's a thankless creative job.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I feel like this is actually setting up Discovery to really go where no one has gone before and become a Star Trek show that's offering something completely new and different.
If we want to just add further fuel to the fire for this Pike speculation of a spinoff, and we're recording this the night of the finale on Thursday, so who
knows?
Mere
moments after watching it.
Yeah, who knows what kind of news has broken between now and the time that this podcast hits the feeds that you guys are all listening to. But as far as we know, there isn't officially a Pike spinoff, but I think everything that they're doing is setting up a Pike spinoff, especially the last, 7 minutes of the show. How could CBS not be trying to like telegraph to everybody, stay tuned?
And just things like Anson Mount saying to like the press, we need to have some creative discussions. He's not saying
his agent needs to have some creative discussions about his salary with CBS executives.
But that's the sort of statement that someone who knows something could be moving is going to say. If he thinks this thing's dead in the water, and he's like, we need to have creative discussions, and the CBS is like, no, we don't.
Well, exactly.
Like, this is definitely wheels in motion, because you know what? CBS has announced several Star Trek spinoff shows.
Hell on wheels in motion.
None of them have gotten the amount of excitement about the one they haven't actually announced, which is a potential Pike spinoff,
yeah,
which people are going nuts for it. like they announced, you know, like Lower Decks, and we're excited about Lower Decks. I can't wait for it, but it did not exactly blow up the internet.
Yeah.
So I think this Pike one is definitely
the Section 31.
No, yeah. No. I mean, fans were interested in talking about it, but this feels like something that especially casual viewers who watch Discovery, who didn't watch the other shows, don't really care that much about Lower Decks or something, would be genuinely interested. Like, you can grab casual viewers of Discovery onto two shows now with this.
So adding fuel to that fire, though, does it not make sense for one series, a 1701 spinoff, to be in one timeline and mm-hmm. then Discovery to be in another timeline? Because wouldn't it be a little weird if you had two series running concurrently within the same timeline?
I'm glad you brought that up, because they'd always said, we want these shows to feel very different from one another, which was always a little bit of the stumbling block with a Pike spinoff, where you're like, well, is it just that and Discovery in the same time period? How do you make those two feel radically different? And now you have that window open.
And we also speculated that maybe Spock was going to be part of season 3 on Discovery, because maybe he was trapped, you know, within this time travel shenanigans as well. And look, they've established him back on the 1701. I think part of that is a creative deal, because then I think if you see Spock on Discovery in season 3, everyone's going to be saying to themselves, well, I know he ends up on the Enterprise eventually, so everyone's going to get home safely.
Exactly,
and that removes a lot of the tension from it. So I understand it from that, but it just seems as if everything that CBS is doing right now is signaling that a 1701 spinoff is an inevitability at this point.
Yeah. So. I just, you know, watching this finale, which I'm still just blown away by, I'm kind of been stunned about this one. I feel like maybe a lot of people did about seeing the first part of Best of Both Worlds or something, where you're just like, what did I just watch?
Yeah.
But, like, I can't help but wonder, you know, Lucasfilm is getting ready to prep their Star Wars shows. Word on The Mandalorian has been very strong. If you're a sci-fi show on a streaming network, I think you want to establish, like, why people should be watching you. And I think Discovery did that tonight. Like, it's offering something that's much bigger than what you might expect. And, you know, we saw how many ship battles in season 1?
Probably, like, 4 that I can think of off the top of my head. The Battle of Binary Stars. Yeah. We had the one at the start of CV Pacem Parabellum.
There's the one in the Mirror Universe.
Yeah.
Yeah. None of them touched this. It even came close.
No.
This really did feel like the level of ambition, the level of technical ability, the level of craftsmanship was just significantly heightened. And not just in the battles, you know, the whole like Burnham soaring through the timeline, through the wormhole, was absolutely incredible.
Which is, I was thinking, like, at first, you know, 2001,
sure,
I get it, guys.
Or Star Trek, the motion picture.
Yeah, but, you know, by the time she's doing that, I'm like, you know, I'm just totally buying into this journey that she's going on. And CBS is definitely buying in on this journey with the dollars they're putting down for
it.
It's so funny to think about how there's so much tumultuous behind-the-scenes stuff going on early on in season 2.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, the sources say it's because of budget issues. Any budget issues going on in this episode, Cam?
They're like, you didn't spend enough.
Well, let's take it away again with other big character moments. We have the demise of two notable characters here.
Yeah.
Admiral Cornwall
I figured that one out in advance, did you?
I kept wondering, why is she standing behind Pike on the bridge the whole time, not really doing anything? They had to give her something to do. So when you're in that moment where you're trying to deactivate the torpedo, number one is there. I don't think I don't think number one's going anywhere.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I think Cornwall's going to die pretty soon, because what else could be the end of it? Because we know the Enterprise is not going to be destroyed.
I had a moment, too, where I'm like, wait, why is Cornwall here? Like, I understand, you know, yes, they've put, you know, these beats in place to have her there for this moment, but I'm like, story-wise, why is she here? You know, the economy of characters theory, you don't really need this character unless ...
Yeah.
But I thought they gave her a big emotional send-off. And this is a character that I think kind of at least frustrated us a little bit, and that she was set up so awesome and just like a really intelligent, smart, capable character who then just began to do things that were either dumb or just kind of shady, like that typical Starfleet shady admiral stuff. But I like that they gave her a big redeeming send-off. And, you know, I am very curious who they set up as maybe an admiral in the future seasons.
It's going to be the resurrected Brett Anderson. Can't wait. The other big, you know, death that we had was one Leland.
Mm-hmm.
Did it pack an emotional punch for you, or at least the visuals with him disintegrating?
I mean, okay, the Leland stuff is goofy. It's really goofy. I don't know that it – that has been one of our nitpicks about the whole season, was the Section 31 you know, Leland story.
And just Section 31 being dopey.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think the Leland send-off was so great that it, you know, it really was like, well, that was all completely flawless.
Yeah, I know.
It was still pretty goofy. I think everything that's going on around it, all the circumstances surrounding this with the whole battle with the drones, that's where the excitement is and what it's bringing out of the characters. The actual fighting and everything with Leland was technically well done. Like, I like the Inception kind of, you know, fight where the gravity's messed up and Nan and Giorgio are beating the heck out of Leland. That was fantastic.
You say Inception, I'm thinking Lionel Richie.
Dancing or was on it, the ceiling?
Yeah. Was it Ray Parker Jr. that did that music video back in the 1980s?
Whoever it is, that's our exit music in this week's episode. Yeah. But yeah, like, I thought that stuff was really fun. Like, the Leland character never really worked for me that strongly, but...
Leland Richie?
Oh, boy. But I did think this whole final fight with him was fantastic. It was well done. It was exciting. It was awesome seeing Nan fight alongside Giorgio. That was something. Yum, yum. That was a weird moment.
Well, look, she at least got to call him an AI sausage, I love that particular phrase. Yeah. I'm going to be using that as an insult everywhere else I go and I encounter, you know, cybernetic organisms that I guess are not the Borg.
No, thank God. But, I mean, I thought the death of Leland was, it was actually easier than I would have thought.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah, magnets, that'll do it.
I wonder where we've seen that before, Cam. Yeah. In Venom.
Yeah, no kidding. Or I was thinking even like Terminator 3.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yep, if you got an AI or a robot, get yourself some magnets.
Yeah.
And it was fine. Like, you know, it was great watching Michelle Yeoh just milk that moment where Leland's being torn apart by the magnets and all the force, and she's just like smiling at him.
So what's going on with Stamets and Culber right now? Is Stamets...
I called this, that they were going to get them back together.
Oh, see, that's just it. I'm watching this and I'm like, Stamets is having a dream. He's hallucinating right now.
That is not at all what I thought.
Okay. Because I was wondering if in Stamets' own head, he was thinking, like, Culber is saying this to him. Culber is saying, you're my home. For me, this works for me. And I really, at the end of the last episode, I was like, okay, mm-hmm. This marriage has finally come to a conclusion. It's just going to feel really forced if they put them back together. You come back with this particular moment, and I was hesitant about it because, look, it worked for me if I was viewing it through the lens of outside observer. But for me, the way that they filmed it, the way that right. Stamets was interpreting things, I got the sense very much that he was almost hallucinating, that this would be his idealized version of how they get back together. And I'm not 100% convinced at this point. And look, I've been proven wrong before because they did establish that, in fact, Michael Burnham's mom had been hanging around for 20 years on that planet. And I was dead set that nope, not at all.
Yeah.
So who knows?
I did love Culber's, like, I thought I could escape going to the Enterprise, but I couldn't. So I'm back and I'm like, yep, that trip on the Enterprise, that was something else with Culber.
The
non-existent
8 minutes. Yeah. Is there? Okay.
Discovery gets things done quickly.
Okay.
The thing is, I feel like this episode needed a finale to that relationship to move on for season 3. I think we got it.
But
I don't think setting it up as this ambiguous thing is...
But okay, we're still not in agreement, though.
That's true.
I think it works so much better, though, if they are apart. Like, I will be disappointed.
Well, now they're stranded together wherever they are.
No, but you're still interpreting it very literally, and I'm not, though. So that's just it. Like, I still think it makes more sense that this is just, you know, Stamets' hallucination. And the way that they filmed that...
It was strange, yeah.
The way that they filmed that seems to indicate that's what the deal was. But believe me, I have no illusions. I think very much that the show could come back and say, nope, that's literally Culber right there.
I thought it was more that he was kind of blacking out from pain and then he saw, then Culber came and that kind of snapped him too. That was the way I interpreted
it. But did you see the reaction shots from the rest of the medical staff though?
No, I didn't.
Like they were looking at Stamets as like, what's this guy talking about? What's he babbling about? So that's again why I keep thinking about like,
I'm going to have to go back and watch this. I mean, I'll be watching this episode again anyway, but
yeah.
That's the thing. In an episode like this, it's like a freight train.
But I would much prefer, okay, not just to be proven right, but I'd much prefer this as a conclusion because I think it's so much more tragic for these two characters, though. And is this not going to provide them a legit excuse, the writers, a legit excuse to keep these two characters separated for, you know, reasons that I guess the audience could buy that's congruent where how the relationship... It just seems to be over thematically. And it's also setting up Culber to be the Dr. Boyce replacement on any potential 1701 spinoff moving forward without giving away the fact that Culber is going to be on the 1701 because they've at least let us believe it. I have no doubt I'm overthinking this to the nth degree.
Guess, here's my question. Does Discovery seem like a show that would do that?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
That, and
Ash Tyler just kept coming back, Tyler.
And he's now the commander. This man who is born a Klingon is now leading Starfleet Black Ops.
Yes, and they're going to be more transparent.
You and I were laughing so hard when we heard that line.
I mean, that feels like the type of thing said to set up a spinoff, because then they can kind of reposition Section 31 for what they want it to be for the spinoff, and then trace the journey of how it became the Section 31 we all know.
I'm still not convinced there's going to be a Section 31 spinoff, more so than just a Georgiou spinoff.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, I don't know what the future of Ash Tyler holds for this franchise, though, because they've done everything they can to keep this guy within the series. Jumping off that, though, we do have the return of the Klingons.
So great.
Along
so
with great. The Kelpian Warriors.
That was odd. When Saru's sister came soaring in there, I was like, wow, this I did not expect. I mean,
no.
Poe was one thing, and then here come the Klingons, and then here come the Kelpians.
Yeah. But, you know, to me, it felt almost as if it was the most Star Trek moment.
It was, and that they all unite together.
Yeah, yeah, which is what Star Trek's all about.
Was it a step too far, though? Did it feel a little goofy?
Okay, in the moment, it worked for me.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll say that. I think the, you know, Serana in that ship, that fighter was a little goofy.
With Saru's like, you learned to fly a fighter.
She was literally a gardener a month ago. Yo. Maybe that Vrahai had a much larger impact on her than
she's
ever
suspected.
She's
fearless now.
Yeah. So.
She's like, I'll fly this thing. I've never even tried one before.
But Cam, what does the future of Laurel hold? Because this is a Klingon chancellor willing to team up with the Federation. She can recognize things. But by the time we get to the James Kirk era, we know that this is not kind of the friendly relationship we can expect moving forward.
Yeah.
So does Laurel become a more, I guess, aggressive leader, or is she eliminated in the coming season somehow?
But what show is she on?
Well, that's just it. Like, it must be this Pike spinoff we're speculating about. It's tough for us to discuss this because I think you and I are treating it almost as if it's a given.
Yeah.
What if it's not? And
it would be amazing if the premiere of season 3 was then popping back into the normal timeline and being like, well, that was weird.
Yeah, exactly. So, but look, the D7s in action in a way we've never seen them before.
Yeah.
In Star Trek, period.
And like the big ship too, coming and just crushing everything in its path.
The ice cutter.
Yeah.
Like that looked pretty badass. And we really haven't seen that bad boy in action since the Battle of the Binary Stars.
R.I.P. Brett Anderson.
Sorry, Brett Anderson. Yeah, yeah. I know.
And getting to see Laurel in battle, like, we all know Laurel
today
can
is
be
a good
badass.
Day to die.
Yeah, we all know Laurel can be a total badass, but we haven't really gotten to see that this season.
There's only three episodes.
We
with
did
her.
Get that fight scene, I guess, in Point of Light. It's just that episode was kind of lame. Like, that fight scene did not give me anywhere even close to the visceral thrills that I got from this episode.
Where do you think Laurel is headed, assuming that we do get to follow her journey moving forward?
The series so far has played this very, you know, intense Shakespearean drama with the Klingon rulership. So it makes sense for me that we would continue down that path and we would be ultimately set up to where the Klingons are when the original series kicks in.
Yeah.
I'm just a little unclear as to when and where that would happen.
I'm baffled.
I mean, you could leave it behind. I don't know. Like, is it something that you could just
Laurel
say?
Is just such a fan favorite, though.
I know. That's the part that's tough. This is very confusing because we got Ash Tyler in the past.
Ash
Laurel.
Tyler is not a fan favorite, but he's been wedged into the series.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I am curious if they are a little secretive about cast members coming back for season 3, just because we don't know what the pieces are right now. Like, I don't know that you're going to see, like, you know, one of those notices going out to Hollywood Reporter or something saying, like, Discovery Season 3 will be back with Shahzad Latif and all that sort of stuff. I wonder if they may keep it a little closer to the vest.
Okay, so we were just talking about, say, the return of the Warriors of Kaminar.
Yeah.
Where is Saru in Season 3? He is, I guess, the acting captain. He is the one leading the ship moving forward.
Well, they still have to have talks about this, Tyler.
Yeah, that's what the big cliffhanger was last episode.
Or is he so in awe of Burnham flying the Red Angel suit that it's just like, you know what? You may have earned this one.
You know, I think it's the Varahai that is pushing him over the top here. I think he's got to be the commander moving forward. And it's going to be interesting, especially when they're stranded in space and how he tackles things in a way that we wouldn't necessarily have expected from Saru back in episode one, where even looking at a telescope made him a little like jittery.
Yeah, where now he's like quoting Sun Tzu.
I would not expect that.
No, yeah. Yeah. That was great. Like, I do love how they've worked Georgiou in with just the camaraderie of this cast.
She had this great eyebrow raise when she was watching Leland just get, like, eviscerated.
Oh,
it's
great. She's, like, smirking.
I mean, it's sociopathic.
Yeah.
But you know what? If this is the character who's having more fun than anyone else on a very serious show...
Is it sociopathic if it's an AI?
It's sociopathic because we know she is a sociopath.
Sure.
So, and look, the AI is, it's kind of this, you know, anthropomorphized version of AI.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, let me ask you this. Let's say if there's like an android walking around, a Data, if you will.
Sure.
And you start,
you make
like,
him really lovable like Data, right?
No, but let's say you start like poking him in the face with a knife and you're taking pleasure in that. I would call that sociopathic.
Sure. Yeah, that does make sense.
So.
Although given everything that Leland has done. I mean, we're willing to give her a pass on this one.
Yeah. Okay, so we've been covering a lot of the character beats. I do want to go into, like, kind of the overall season arc here, but are there any other maybe big character beats that you want to touch on before we move on?
Character beats? I don't know if there's a lot. I was really happy to see Jet Reno going along with them in the end. I had actually figured that character was a goner. That's the one I thought was going to be gone.
Yeah, it was strange because, you know, you and I were texting, and I was like, well... Why is Nan hanging around? Like, why would she volunteer? And it looks as if about almost every single person from the Discovery crew decided to hang around.
Yeah.
Which is, okay. But so I was convinced Nan was going to die. You were convinced Jet Reno was going to die. And they're both here and alive. So.
I am getting a little curious, though, with Discovery in that, like, they've stuck with most of their primaries now for two seasons. You know, fans love them. Are we entering a Scream franchise problem where... No one wants to see their beloved characters killed in a show where they said people can die at any moment.
So who's the Jamie Kennedy of season three?
Ash Tyler.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, is this kind of an issue where they always wanted us to question who could go? Because in season one, people did die quite a bit.
So I think the only one who's realistically on the chopping block would be Saru. Mm-hmm. Because of the situation they're in, assuming that the rest of the series takes place in the future.
Right.
He would pass, and that's how Burnham would assume the mantle.
Sure.
Mind you, I don't think it necessarily works from a storytelling perspective after the Obol for Charon episode, where we get that quote-unquote death sequence that hits one of the emotional high points that this character's ever experienced, at least as us as viewers.
Right.
So, because they're not going to kill off Tilly. They're not going to kill off Burnham.
Yeah.
I don't think they can do that with Stamets, especially after the previous season's Hugh Culber
fiasco. He's had too many close calls. Like, Stamets keeps getting hurt really badly.
Yeah. So, who really out of the regulars is left?
It's a different franchise than Scream, which is obviously a slasher franchise. But that was the problem as you got into further sequels, where it's like all your mains were, you knew there was nothing bad was going to happen to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is curious because they did very much up front say Discovery would have something of a rotating cast because it wasn't going to be like other shows. It was going to, you know, have constant stakes of like anyone could go at any time.
So the regular that we lost last season was Jason Isaacs as Lorca.
Yeah. You kind of lost Culber. He's not a regular, but he is a recurring, you know, character tied to one of your main.
In season one?
Yeah, in season one.
Right.
Yeah.
And at this point, I guess the biggest... death we had in, and they had a lot of teases of deaths in season two, but the biggest one, is it Cornwall?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, well, I mean, Cornwall and Arium.
No, I think Cornwall is the most significant character.
She's the
though.
Bigger character, yeah. Arium was on
I would not say that Arium was a more significant character to die.
From her funeral, Tyler, I disagree.
I can't wait until we get to listen to Saru sing in the season premiere. Yeah. No, I would say far and away, Cornwall was the most significant death. I'm not saying that her death was done better than Arium's episode in Project Daedalus. Not at all. I think that she was given a showcase that Cornwall was not, but I think that's the most significant death of the season.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
So I just wonder, I'm with you. okay, if there are stakes within the show, who's really on the chopping block? And I can think...
I don't really care.
It's only Lily Saru.
I don't really care if they kill off any of our mains, because, look, I watch TNG, I watch DS9. Most of the cast never died on those shows, other than Jadzia at the end of season 6.
Well, Tasha Yar. And then you go to Voyager, we had, say, Kes. I think it's really just Enterprise that was the safe cast.
Except for the last episode, yeah.
Well, spoiler, I haven't gotten that. I've still been waiting for that one, man.
But yeah,
Porthos?
I am going to be curious to see how they go moving forward, or if they want to maybe tone down some of the life as we know it is going to be wiped out, and people are going to be dying in this final battle stuff.
And that's just it. Like, I want them to move away from those kinds of stakes. Go back into more of the emotional stuff. The reason why this episode works for me is not because of the big action sequences. It's because the action sequences are tied to the emotional character beats that I'm invested in. Just look, you're asking how do they top this in the season 3 finale? They shouldn't try to.
Yeah.
They should go smaller, but I'm not talking will you take my hand sort of small.
I remember Joss Whedon said that after the first Avengers. They're like, how do you top this? He's like, you go smaller. And then he makes Age of Ultron.
is Age of Ultron the movie that he wanted to make? I don't think so. I don't get that sense.
But before we kind of move on to more serious topics, I want to just touch on two moments that I absolutely, absolutely loved. Number one was Burnham soaring through with the wings, surrounded by like the escort of shuttles.
Yeah.
That may be one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life. And I'm not talking about Star Trek. I just mean in my life.
The majesty.
Oh my God.
Around that.
The score swelling. I mean, that was everything I never knew I wanted in my life.
They went all out on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the other moment, Cam?
Just some of the Pike stuff. Pike getting those great moments on the bridge, being like, hit it. And just like, this is Starfleet. Get it done. And then I really loved the whole prepping for battle right off the top, where you had some really creative techniques. You had split screen going on. You had lots of scenes of characters, like the camera, almost like a Robert Altman film, going back and forth between different little bits of action going on in preparation for battle. Like, again, the level of filmmaking going on in this finale was so head and shoulders above a lot of what Discovery's done.
It's definitely a different era from what we got with the Berman Star Trek franchise, where it was very much master shot, close-up, close-up, master shot. That was what the directing was. Here, you brought up the split screen.
Yeah.
We've never seen anything look like that in Star Trek before. And the fact that they're willing to experiment in such a big budgeted episode, look, more power to them. I want Star Trek to look interesting again, you know? I want there to be this certain kind of majesty that, as much as we love the stories that they're telling, let's match that with, like, these amazing visuals, which, look, no argument. They did that this evening.
It's weird to me that in season one, it didn't seem like they were really trying to necessarily replicate the J.J. Abrams aesthetic that was in 2009 and Into Darkness. But it does feel like they've gotten closer to that. Like, Brother felt very much like they were trying to do some of the J.J. stuff. And this episode did as well. Like, and I'm not against it. I'm not complaining about it at all. I think it works 100%. And it shows us a way into Star Trek that's different than we've really seen before. I don't know that why it was necessarily deemed as like, well, we don't want to do that necessarily. Because season one didn't feel like they were doing it that much.
They're just becoming more confident with themselves. And all the power to them for that.
For sure. Okay. And finally, one last thing. I love the whole medbay sequence when all these people are being brought in injured. And you get to see like a medbay that actually feels like it would during one of these battles.
The closest, and I'm being totally genuine, though, is actually Star Trek Generations with the Enterprise B. I think that really, you know, captured what you're talking about. But beyond that, we haven't seen too much of that.
It's just like they usually can't afford extras.
Yeah.
You know, you'd see an episode of like, there's the one in TNG where isn't there like everyone's getting sick or something and they're putting them all in the, in 10 forward?
I think that's like every other episode of
TNG. But it's an episode where you've got a lot of extras and it's like you get the sense more of like escalating problems on the ship and how people are injured and how they have to stack them up when there's a serious emergency like this. They have done it before, but never like this with that level of energy with, again, the camera whipping between different doctors and that stuff.
One of the lines from the Star Trek Generations commentary that always sticks with me is Brandon Braga and
saying,
Ron Moore.
We're sorry.
They did that a lot. Yeah. But there's that introduction to Sorin in 10 forward, and the guys were talking about how the fact like this is how they always wanted 10 forward to feel, like it was packed with extras. They wanted it to feel like really like bustling, whereas you watch the show, there's maybe seven other people other than the main cast, like, hanging around in, like, this bar.
I always feel bad kind of ridiculing that because they just, you know, the purse strings were very tight for that show a lot of the time. But I get it. It does have an impact just having bodies in the frame.
Yeah.
You get why, like, when Christopher Nolan made The Dark Knight Rises, he was really propelled by the idea of wanting to have the biggest cast, like, of extras, just, like, having massive amounts of people.
A whole football stadium full.
Yeah, a whole football stadium, sure. Yeah. But it's, like, that kind of scale really does add a lot. It adds more than, you know, CG effects.
Speaking of scale, maybe let's talk about the scale of the season as a whole.
Yeah.
I think what we want to do, though, is maybe about a month from now, maybe towards the end of May, we're going to do kind of an overall review of the season. But I think we can still kind of dissect how we're feeling as of now, as watching the finale and the story arc that we're following here. One of our criticisms for season one is that the Klingon War was not necessarily the most compelling story that we got to follow, despite the fact that we liked a lot of the episodes, we liked a lot of the characters.
And I'll even say the story in the Mirror Universe wasn't the most compelling. You had some really strong episodes in there,
yeah.
But as an overall four-episode story, it was like, it had its ups and downs, for sure.
For this one, I still think that Discovery's strengths rests in the character moments, and The Red Angel arc in this episode, 100%, totally worked for me. There are a few other episodes, like, say, the Red Angel. Right. I'm buying into that. But for them to ask us, you know, for 9 episodes to just go along with it, make it seem as if we should care about this, it didn't quite work for me. I think, again, as an ongoing, you know, season-long arc, they didn't do enough to make this compelling out of the gate. And so I had trouble getting invested in what was going on throughout. And I hope that they learn that lesson moving into season 3. And, like, I don't want to be one of those fans who's stuck in, like, the next gen era of Trek.
We had some comments like those on our video last week.
Yeah, but I still think that Star Trek works really well if you're doing those more episodic shows.
And I do think Discovery made a really good concentrated effort to give us episodes like that in season 2. You know, like, New Eden's the one you like to bring up a lot. But I think the issue was that they would have these really interesting, strong, standalone stories, and even the ones that didn't work, at least they were doing something that was unique to that episode.
Yeah.
But they would bury it in a lot of, you know, strands of fodder that would lead to the next episode, or, you know, teasing Spock stuff or Red Angel stuff. And you're kind of like, I kind of just want to have this adventure.
The other thing that I struggled with, though, is some of the techno babble. Like, I rewatched Such Sweet Sorrow, part one, last night, and there's this techno babble where I'm like, huh? Like, wait, like, I love the character beats, you know? Look, if you just follow the character beats, that's totally fine. But I literally did not know what the characters were even talking about in the previous episode. Like, they kept talking about the cage and energy. And expanding the cage.
I felt that way a little bit in this episode when they're talking about the time travel.
But there's enough momentum going along with it that you're like, fine.
It's kind of the JJ approach where you just keep it moving.
Yeah.
But when I was sitting there listening to Burnham and Spock walk through how this Red Angel was going to work in terms of setting the time and everything properly, I'm like, wait, what?
I know.
Like, I need, you know, that awkward scene where the character pulls out a whiteboard and explains it to the audience. You know, I always hate those scenes, but in this case, I'm actually like, I kind of need that because I'm almost like, this feels almost like Terminator time travel where it's like, we have to go back so all this happens. And it's like, but if it's happening, didn't it already happen?
I don't know how much my opinion's going to change upon rewatch.
For sure.
Especially, look, they had all those, like, moments with Burnham traveling back through time and experiencing a lot of season 2 again, knowing that it's Burnham this whole time. I think there's actually already a lot of speculation that she was the Red Angel.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just going to be like, yep, there's Burnham. I know where the story's going. So
yeah, it's kind of like, and I think this was a far more successful season in a lot of ways than season 1, but it is sort of the sort of thing that, like, revisiting season 2, I feel like, is going to be kind of like the, well, if you go back, all the seeds for Lorca are planted throughout. Mm-hmm. And you go back and you're like, yep, there's Burnham.
Yeah.
And I don't know that you get a lot of context beyond that. Like, not enough that it's like that kind of bombshell, the ending of Usual Suspects type thing, you know, where I'm going to be going back to the start of season 2 and being like, oh my God, I had no idea where this was going.
So I have something in my brain, and maybe I'll go further into it in this season-long recap episode that we're going to do after we sit on this for a couple weeks here.
Don't forget our Blu-ray episode-by-episode review further down the road.
So much more Discovery Season 2 content in store. But I think Season 1 seemed a little bit more epic to a certain degree. Despite the fact that the Klingon War didn't necessarily work for us the whole time, and the Mirror Universe stuff didn't necessarily work for us the whole time.
It felt very big out of the gate when they're setting up a Klingon War right in Episode 1. Yeah. No, you are right.
But this season seemed far more confident.
Especially partway through, where it seemed like the previous showrunners were replaced.
Yeah. I think once you get to, say, Talos 4, this show becomes far more consistent and far more confident with itself. It's going to be interesting for me to buckle down. I'll give you my hot take. I think season 2 was overall a stronger, more cohesive season.
Yeah.
I just wonder if there are more highs for me with just regards to the novelty of a brand new Star Trek series on TV when I'm watching season 1.
I think for me, I would say season 2 is better than 1. It feels more consistent than 1. 1 is really all over the place. Yep. One does a really, really good job putting all the pieces in place. Like, I think it sets up its characters very well. Like, that's what season 1 did really well for me. But I think this last run of episodes in season 2, and especially the presence of Pike in season 2, really, really elevates the season very high, especially this last batch of episodes. To me, this is as good as Star Trek Discovery has ever been, especially in this episode in particular.
Despite the high points of one Pike, I still think that they've proven going into season 3 that, Discovery doesn't need him. Like, it's got a strong enough character group that I'm invested in what's going on with these people. And I really do dig kind of the setting and hopefully what I believe is the premise of the entire series moving forward. I think that really works for what the show is all about.
And that ship got a hell of a farewell.
Hell yeah.
From Pike and everyone. Like, what a great moment.
Yeah.
And just beautiful cinematography and effects work.
No Harry Mudd this season, other than the short trek.
Yeah.
That surprised me.
Yeah, I would have expected that because, they set him up in 2 episodes in season 1 as someone who would be popping in and out. And will we ever see him again?
In Discovery? So, I can't imagine it, but...
Maybe he shows up on a Pike spinoff if it
happens.
But
Spock doesn't know who the guy is. Maybe Spock's on shore leave or something.
Maybe that was the last we saw of Harry Mudd. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just kind of strange. But look, we kind of talked about whether we'd watch like a 20-minute long, Harry Mudd episode.
There were, some rumors that a Harry Mudd was a character they were considering as a spinoff character.
Yeah, so look,
doesn't mean it'll happen.
I'm down for a Harry Mudd sitcom, but my concern though is the writer of The Escape Artist, Mike McMahon, he's busy show running Star Trek Lower Decks. Is he really going to have time to do both? I don't think so. And I think the reason The Escape Artist works so well is because of Mike McMahon. So
maybe we just get a series of Harry Mudd short treks along the road. I'd be okay with that.
I'd watch that. Yeah. But meanwhile, Rainn Wilson, he's going to be busy with the big Meg franchise, right, Cam? Right?
I think they are. They are doing a sequel, I think.
All right.
So
there you go.
Yeah.
Any kind of final concluding thoughts on what I think we both agree is a very strong finale to a much stronger season 2.
Yeah.
One that exceeds a lot of our disappointment that we experienced in the season 1 finale, where it just seemed more of a deflated exercise in trying to wrap things up.
Do you remember I was saying, I think it was last week when I was saying, I really do think they'll probably have learned something from the finale of season 1.
Yeah.
I really underestimated how much that would prove true.
I just think about, momentum going into season 3, I've never been more excited about where a Star Trek series can be going so early on in the run of a series. I think Star Trek always takes a few seasons to get going, and which is a weird thing because you just can't afford to do that in today's day and age of television. Yeah. But look, I think Star Trek Discovery season 3 might just follow the same path that all the other Star Trek series do, where it takes about 2 seasons for them to figure things out, and then they know exactly what they are.
Yeah, when you look at the other series, like the second season finale doesn't necessarily set up super, super exciting things where you're like, oh my god, I can't believe where we're going next. Some of them are okay, like the three-parter at the at the end of DS9 season 2 is pretty good, but it's also not exactly paving the way for all the greatness that would come with that series.
A three-parter
Sorry, that's in the premiere, isn't it?
That's the season two premiere, yeah.
Yeah, what's the finale of season two?
The Jem Hadar.
That's right. Okay, that's a good episode,
That's a good episode.
It does set it up in an interesting way.
Yeah, it's a good setup episode.
Yeah. You know? But it's more like a setup episode that you know is great in retrospect, whereas at the time you'd be like, well, maybe you get a couple more episodes based on this.
I 100% agree. But you know what? They hit it at the ballpark when they came back for, you know, the Search parts one and two.
Yeah.
So I can only hope that Discovery does the same when it comes back for season three.
Let's hope so. I mean, I'm kind of just bowled over at how effective this was as a finale.
Yeah.
In the sense of, like, I feel already, like, great anticipation for season three, which I didn't really feel at the end of season one. Like, I was excited.
I agree.
I was like, well, let's see where the show goes now. Hopefully they figured out some of the kinks. And, you know, we would find out things like, oh, Pike's going to be there. You're like, okay, I wonder what that could be. But there wasn't that sense of, like, well, I cannot imagine where this is going.
The question I still had in my head after the end of season one was, like, I don't know what the show is about. I don't know what it's about. I don't have that question anymore. And that makes me far more excited than I've been for Discovery since, you know, the series premiere.
Right. So. No, it was something. And I eagerly look forward to talking more about this episode later down the road when... Yeah. It sort of settled into my mind a bit, and I've rewatched it and gotten more of a grasp on the moment-to-moment kind of play out, because this thing is overwhelming. Like, this really almost felt like when I saw The Dark Knight in IMAX, you know, the midnight premiere, and it's just like, I got to see that movie again.
Yeah.
Because so much happened.
Okay, CBS, get this on IMAX for Cam.
Oh, can you imagine? That would have been great.
My mind is already melting.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Okay, so what our goal is, and from what we understand, is that the What We Left Behind Deep Space Nine documentary, it's going to be streaming for people that signed up for that Indiegogo campaign, which you and I both did.
Mm-hmm.
But look, I have no doubt that there could be some technical issues behind us watching this and getting an episode out, but that is essentially what our goal is to do this one. If not, there's another idea that I have in store that I don't want to spoil it just yet, because we will be doing it later on down the road.
Best of the Bullions. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam. V is in very impressed by Spock in his blue uniform, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REP. P as in Pike is also very impressed with Spock in the blue uniform. O-R-T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.